Hello, welcome everybody. So for those of you who don't know, we're a couple of Canadians, and we thank you for welcoming us to your fair European city. We spent some time here just before presenting to kind of check out the sights. It's a great town, and we enjoy the evenings hanging out here as well. So before we get started, I like to take sort of a demographic of the room. Derek has walked around a little bit and sort of given me an idea of what it is you're looking for. Just so that I have an idea, I'm going to ask you a pretty difficult question here. How many Europeans are in the audience? Okay, so that one was kind of easy. Any North Americans? All right. So we're going to be doing this session in Spanish. No, seriously, we would try, but you probably wouldn't enjoy it very much. So Derek and I work for Systel Technology in Ottawa, Canada. We're a systems integrator. We focus on System Center and Link, actually, as a practice focus. We are going to discuss integration with System Center and Link and Exchange, and also virtualization considerations at sort of the beginning of the presentation. That's what we're going to focus on. We'll leave some time at the end for questions because we've got a fair amount of content to go through. Derek is a senior solutions architect for Systel. I'm a system center and virtual machine architect, a little more specific because Derek focuses a lot on the Link side too. So that's why his title is a little more broad. So we can get rolling. So we're going to start the presentation off by discussing virtualization considerations and why and how you would virtualize Exchange 2013, and then we'll roll into Link 2013 and those virtualization considerations. Then we'll move into the sort of the demo portion of this presentation, which is the integration and management using Microsoft System Center. We're going to cover integrating with Operations Manager. We're going to cover integration with Service Manager, which is sort of the middle piece. And we've got a demo planned also for Orchestrator, where you're actually going to see a situation where we do a Link failover. Okay? So to get things started, how many of you are using Hyper-V to do your virtualization? Oh, that's a pretty good quantity.
How many are virtualizing on 2012?
Okay.
Awesome.
So there's still a lot on 2008. But
yeah, but that's a lot more hands than we see in North America.
That's true.
How many are virtualizing with the other guys? Oh, far too many hands. At least start thinking about looking at Hyper-V virtualization and maybe dev as a first step because, you know, from a licensing perspective, there's some considerable changes between the two product stacks now.
Yeah. When it comes down to management and integration with System Center, we can handle that if your platforms are virtualized with either VMware or Hyper-V. So the story is very similar regardless. And in fact, we can actually manage the virtual machines themselves using Virtual Machine Manager today. We've been able to do that back for a couple of versions as well. If you're using 2012 today for your virtualization, you've actually got a significant advantage to virtualization. I'm pretty sure most of you are aware of some of the scalability enhancements. You can go with up to 4 terabytes of memory and up to 320 logical processors on your host.
How many people have 4 terabytes in their host? Okay, just, you know.
If you needed to, you could. and your guests, you can actually go up to, you're no longer limited to just doing 4 virtual CPUs, you can go up to 64. So those really hungry database servers, you can now do that on Hyper-V. There's some really good storage capabilities there as well. Now we already spoke about the capability to go up to 64 terabytes, but now within the operating system, you can actually do something that was possible only with SAN software before, which is the SAN to SAN migration. That is called the offloaded data transfer, right? So where you can use the operating system capabilities, it can detect the, as long as it's compatible with 2012, it can detect that capability and handle that within the operating system. So you no longer need the separate UI in order to handle those capabilities. You've also got integrated support for Fibre Channel, which wasn't possible before, and which has come back is the iSCSI capability, and of course the SMB3 capability in 2012 as well. Now, are any hosters in the room? Yeah. So it's, generally speaking, there's not a lot of you guys, but in 2012, you've got this new capability called virtual networking. I'm sure you've all seen that, which allows you to sort of maintain two IP subsystems, one which is the sort of external IP that you use to communicate through the organization, and then sort of a customer-facing or tenant-facing IP infrastructure, which is inside your guests, or even you can link to hosts if you needed to on that infrastructure as well. But using virtual networking, you've got some significant enhancement there, and it makes things a lot easier for hosters and the ability to sort of sell services with virtualization and with IT, right?
Yeah, and one clean way of thinking about it is encapsulation. We've been doing that for a long time. That way we have multiple hosters that or clients or tenants with inside the host. We can all use 192.168.100.x if we feel like it.
Yeah, and you can do that between sites, right? So as long as you've got the virtual networking set up and your devices can communicate, then you can do that between sites. It's not a problem. Now, some significant new enhancements with the R2 release, which you've got access to the preview bits. So you guys have been doing virtualization for a while. Hopefully some of you have managed to sit on some of the server sessions where they talk about the new capabilities of Hyper-V 2012 R2. That stuff that you have in the virtual machines, which dates back to the 486 PC days, things like the ISA bus, the PCI to ISA translator and controller, that stuff has all been removed in the version generation 2 virtual machines, which are now in 2012 R2. So significantly lighter weight virtual machines, right? So you've now got the, like, there are advantages to virtualizing any workload anyways, because you don't have that dependency on the hardware drivers. It basically virtualizes everything and uses synthetic drivers to handle a lot of that communication. Well, you now can go inside and lighten what was already a lighter load to begin with. It has a lot of new capabilities, always UEFI secure boot capable. Also, you can now boot where you couldn't from the past from a synthetic SCSI adapter, right? Before, you had to have your boot device connected to an IDE. Well, that's no longer absolutely necessary. You can do it straight from a SCSI controller, which has been an advantage for a lot of people and something we've been looking for years, actually, because that's really emulating what we do with our servers, is it not? Today, for the 2012 R2 platform, the supported guest operating systems are Windows 8 and Server 2012, and then you've got the 64-bit versions of those, and also the new Windows 8.1 and Server 2012 R2. But further support's going to be announced as the product gets released. I'd watch for that.
How many of you do work for federal government space, or are equivalent of federal government? Okay, this doesn't apply to you if your government's anything like ours in Canada. You know, we're all running 3 or 4 year old servers and those types of things, so it's definitely a caveat that you need to watch. Unless you're on the latest and greatest, it's going to cause you some grief. So you really need to understand the infrastructure and where you're trying to deploy to before you start utilizing this new technology.
Okay. So today, to make your life easier, if you bring in a Server 2012 R2 host, you can live migrate without any problem from your existing Server 2012 host machines to the 2012 R2 machines, okay? This includes a shared nothing live migration, by the way, so you don't even have to have that shared storage infrastructure to get it done. However, as you know, with the shared nothing live migration, there's a time factor in there, but it's not going down while it's actually doing the migration, right? The other thing to remark when you're actually trying to do this, to leverage this capability, is that it's a one-way move, right? So if you go from 2012 to 2012 R2 today, you can't move it back. I don't know that that'll change, but the intent is to move from the older platform into the newer platform, and then you'd be able to leverage some of the newer capabilities of the host and virtualization platform. Okay? Some improvements in the new R2 platform are faster live migration capability, and this is done because of enhanced compression. Also, there's no hardware changes required in order to move from one to another, and it's also the new compression capabilities are by default in the new platform enabled.
Did people attend the keynote and saw the flashy little wheels and moving and doubling? There's some great enhancements with the compression capabilities here.
Okay. So, okay, I'm not going to get too much into the SMB, but here's a new enhancement that's capable, that's possible with the R2 release. Before, you weren't able to dynamically resize the VHDs, right? But with the new VHDX format, you can actually, while it's online, you can resize that on your host, and then the operating system or the guest operating system will take advantage of that new resizing capability, and you could either expand your disk or you can create a new volume, whatever you need to do there. So that's some interesting new capability that's possible for you now as well. In addition, now, so we know that a quick migration is essentially an outage, right? Quick migration is essentially an outage, but it's done quickly, where you actually export the machine and restart it from one host to another. Well, now you've got the capability to do that live. And you can do that with a snapshot as well, right? So you can export a snapshot and a virtual machine while it's running and bring it up on another host. So you've got those capabilities within the R2 release. Okay, so that's just some base platform type stuff and some new capabilities within the R2 Server 2012 release. So why would we virtualize Exchange 2013? Because that's part of the presentation. So just to level set this to begin with, compare what you're always compare when you're considering virtualization with how you do it physically versus how you do it virtually. There are some obvious wins. For example, when you virtualize any workload, you're making it more portable. You're essentially creating a file, and you're creating a configuration file that's significantly more portable than actually setting up a server, right? You now just have to figure out a way to move those two files around. And, of course, what's in the files is state and other information, stuff like that. With the new enhancements on 2012 R2, you've got some benefits there. So, because the operating system has more enhancements, if you virtualize the platform, you get to benefit from that too. Whereas if you deploy physically, sure, you get some benefits if you go and upgrade the underlying host OS, but you get a lot more if you go on Hyper-V as well. So a lot of these benefits are stuff that I've already indicated with the 2012 R2, but they follow through, of course, as benefits to Exchange 2013. So the thing with virtualizing Exchange is that it's not only possible, but it's attractive. And the reason for that is that you can do it for all the role servers, right? That's one reason. The other thing is that if you need to deploy Exchange, you can do it using task sequences. Now, you can do that in a physical environment, but deploying it to a virtual environment is a lot faster because of the file transfer capabilities. You're not deploying to physical metal or physical disks. You're deploying inside a VHD or VHDX, and you get a lot more speed when doing that. So your commitment to set up that environment is going to be significantly less, and it's a lot more scriptable too. Because you've got resource control and granularity in virtualization, that capability transfers to your Exchange workloads as well. And then within Hyper-V, you've got the capability to make the entire system highly available through clustering, right? So within Exchange, you can use your database access groups to make the platform highly available, but you can do it now sort of indirectly, externally, by leveraging the Hyper-V platform as well. So these are advantages and reasons that you would consider virtualizing Exchange versus deploying on a physical machine. Some things to consider about virtualizing Exchange. There's a little bit of some important considerations here. These are always going to tie to and relate to the hardware, okay? So some things to think about. Never forget about the processor. I can't tell you how many times I go to a company and they want to deploy any workload, let it be SQL, let it be Exchange, let it be SharePoint, I don't care. They want to start with one virtual CPU. Don't do that. It's a one-to-one, and at most, it's a two-to-one relationship on cores to vCPUs, right? Cores being physical processor, at most, that's what you can stretch out of this. So the consideration here, and actually the guidance on the TechNet website for Microsoft says the same thing, right? The guidance that is given by Microsoft to physically deploy Exchange is equal to the guidance for virtualization. It is supported. It is a viable option. You just have to pay attention to that stuff. So if it's saying use four cores, use four virtual cores. If it's saying use eight cores, use eight virtual cores. You don't want to stray away from that too much because your performance is going to be unpredictable. Now, that said, there's nothing wrong with going less and testing your workload and adjusting after the fact. If it were physical, would you be able to do that? Not really. If it's virtual, you've got that capability. Okay? There's some other things with regards to virtual memory as well. Now, there's been a lot of improvements with Exchange. Handling virtual memory, sadly, has been sort of a catch-up game. You want to leverage static memory when you set up your virtual machines for Exchange today. The reason for that is that the workload does not catch up and address the fact that the operating system is consuming less, I'll say physical, but we know it's virtual, less memory that it actually has, right? The operating system has some amount of memory. We know if it's a virtual machine, that's really only the startup memory, right? And then from there, it has amounts that you can configure in Hyper-V to go more or less, yes? Well, Exchange doesn't deal well with the virtual memory load, so you'll want to set that static for this particular workload. I believe SharePoint shares some of those same considerations as well.
Same with Link for that aspect as well. SQL's been ahead of the game in the ability to leverage dynamic memory, even some of the new paging capabilities in 2012 that allow us to leverage startup RAM and overcommit our hosts, especially during reboot capabilities. But as Brad said, static is what we need to look at here for any memory sizing considerations.
Okay. Now, there are some new capabilities that were introduced in 2012. Those are still exist within 2012 R2. You have the capability to use fiber channel now with your virtual machines, and you've got the capability not only to do that on the host, but you've got the capability to use virtual fiber channel within the guests, right? And there you've got the in-guest iSCSI as well, always there. When you're picking how to allocate your virtual hard drives, whether that be VHD or VHDX, of course the preference is VHDX because of the enhanced capabilities, you want to use fixed disk, okay? Fixed disk, truly when measuring performance, is as close to real as possible in the virtual machine without going straight to the real metal, because you can map straight to the metal on the hard drive, and that's truly the fastest way. But if you want all those portability capabilities within virtualization, you want to be using fixed disks. If you're using differencing disks, you've got that sort of resizing as we go, as space is needed, and that does take away from your performance at the operating system capability level. Because of the way Server 2012 works with the whole offloaded data transfer and all that, you don't have to do away with your existing storage infrastructures, but the way they've designed the new operating system, you can take a lot more advantage of local disk, right? So you can have a direct attached storage unit. They even sell some that can attach to multiple servers now, so it's sort of like a SAN or a NAS. But direct attached disk really... a lot more customers are using it now, and you can get cheap disk, actually. So it's a good way to sort of tier your storage these days.
One of the number one clients that I can think of that is using JBOTs or these types of devices is Microsoft, for that matter, Office 365. This isn't a SAN infrastructure that's being leveraged here. We have JBOT capabilities. We stack them, we rack them with storage space capabilities now, and there's been a large investment there. We're able to sustain and get considerably high IOP capabilities, as you saw in the demonstration in the keynote, where we are traditionally required an expensive SAN of at least a couple of $1 million to leverage that. Now I can go to my Best Buy or Future Shop or Fry's or whatever that technology, the store of your choice here is, and actually start looking at reducing that cost significantly. The two technologies that I'd like to call out here in my mind from a virtualization standpoint that are the coolest, I love NUMA. NUMA is great, especially of NUMA-aware technologies. Are people aware of what NUMA is? Anybody? So the ability to leverage the RAM that's in channel with the CPU on the host rather than interrupting another CPU to gain access to the RAM that's in host. So what that means is we're able to run calculations and access RAM quicker rather than interrupting a bank that's on another CPU. And this passes down to the guest operating system. So if you have a NUMA-aware technology, previously to 2012, you didn't benefit from that. Now with the 2012 infrastructure and leveraging NUMA, the transactions and access to memory are actually considerably faster because we're able to run in line with whatever core has been assigned to that machine and in turn the memory bank that's being leveraged rather than interrupting and going outside to another CPU where that RAM is in line and in memory. So there's great performance characteristics here with the 2012 feature set. The other one that's very slick is the DVM queuing, where theoretically, and we've seen this in some high workload capabilities, your interrupt in order to gain access to the network interface becomes your bottleneck, okay? In theory, we could actually be sending all of our interrupts to leverage this channel, where now we can spread them across and dynamically queue them rather than creating that bottleneck into one interrupt in order to gain access to the network resource. So, you know, out of all of them, I think those are the two coolest features that have been surfaced in 2012 and have been enhanced in the new R2 release. There'll be some more information around that as the product matures and moves from preview into a more feature state.
Okay. Just a quick note on storage tiering. So we see a lot of customers doing this, right? It's a lot easier when you're using sort of a mapping physical to virtual when you're considering files versus actual disks, right? You set up in the operating system, you set up your RAID volumes, and then you can use your different tiers, like whether you've got an SSD tier or you've got a SAS 7.5K disk tier, and then you set your slower disks on the slower machines and then your faster disks or VHDs on the faster machines, that you get the best performance. That goes without saying.
One of the other things would be the new tiering functionality that's in R2, where we can say my solid state drives are my tier one, my fast storage, my slower storage are my attached drives, and you can start leveraging those new R2 capabilities in order to improve the virtual machine performance for your high workload requirements.
Okay. In R2, there's the support for the Hyper-V replica, which has been improved as well. Forgot to mention that. I just wanted to...
Don't do it with Exchange, SharePoint, and Link.
That's right.
We understand that the workloads and how that memory is being utilized and real-time communications, at least from a Link perspective, do not fare well to this type of replica engine. That's where... previously, Brad said that there's a lot of companies that are starting to look at virtualization as a method for high availability or disaster recovery. It's not a one-size-fits-all for every technology. You really need to understand the workload that you're firing off there. In a nutshell, make sure that you're not defining your DR and HR by virtualization, high availability. There are product-specific technologies that can be leveraged in order to meet HA and DR in a true sense. A lot of clients and customers like to use it in a virtual state because they think that's more cost effective, but give it a try and see how well it works. I'm sure that your end users will be at your door fairly quickly asking you what happened.
Yeah. So just a note to the high availability, application specific high availability capabilities are to be considered first in all cases. Beyond that, you've got the protection when you virtualize that, yes, you can create high availability through clustering using Server 2012 Hyper-V. And actually, it's going to be a supported scenario now by Microsoft. Back in the 2008 days, it used to be application virtualization only, and yes, you can do it, but wasn't actually supported. That has sort of moved forward with the times and is now supported by Microsoft with the 2012 and the 2012 R2. However, guidance is given by Microsoft as well to say consider the application high availability and fault-tolerant capabilities first. Failing that, rely on the virtualization capabilities definitely to be tested to determine the impacts in your environments, right?
You're still going to get the one ping reset. In the end, a lot of these problems are not because of the virtualization technology or what you're leveraging. We have to consider the networking aspects. If I'm on this host with this IP and this MAC address, and I'm now over there, you get a reset. It has to occur because from a switching layer 2 process, it's not where it used to be. And there's a reconvergence that occurs. So it's not a fault of the virtualization technology. It's a fault of the underlying infrastructure that's being leveraged.
Okay. So just this, the reason I put the takeaway slide here is because we kind of segmented the presentation. We've sort of concluded the exchange portion virtualization. We can talk about that in questions, but we're kind of going to switch gears a little bit and move into Link. So some considerations here when you're virtualizing Exchange as a key workload are the processor cores. You can't ignore that. So don't go with one virtual CPU. Or if you do, please make sure to test your metrics and make sure that the thing is working. You're going to find that you're going to have to go closer to actual anyways. We've seen that from experience. Beyond that, Exchange doesn't deal well with dynamic memory. So do set your virtual machines up with static memory. Also, disk I/O is critical, so set up your RAID arrays correctly and the way you actually provision your storage, put it on fast disk tiering. And also, when you're going and designing that Exchange infrastructure, the first role in Exchange to attack is, of course, the mailbox server role. Okay.
So let's talk about a couple of aspects of virtualizing Link. Everything can be virtualized, pretty much. Most of the things that Brad had stated are still holding true. Front-end pools, co-locating mediation servers, fully supported. Standard edition servers, fully supported, with that SQL Express running in the background. Again, very important, test your workloads. Understand your host. What's currently committed on the host? Don't overcommit your host. Again, the best practice numbers are stated to sustain X amount of users over X amount of time. Do you always need a hex core with 32 gigs of RAM for your 40-user customer base? Probably not. Does Microsoft give you recommendations for 40 users? No. Their recommendations are always, how much can I get on a maximum utilization base? So, although they are best practice numbers, really sizing is important. You know, for that matter, if you've got 200 users, Hyper-V version 2 might suffice. You've got four cores, that might be able to handle the workload. So really going through the testing of workloads are important, but the number one thing that we see with our VMware customers is overcommitment. There seems to be an even one-to-one CPU mapping. I hear this all the time, where I should just assign one CPU to the virtual machine and let VMware handle the queuing capabilities because one is somehow better than four. It's not true. You really need to quantify that out one-to-one, max two-to-one. And if your workloads are not that heavy, you can do two-to-one and maybe even three-to-one. Not best practice, but again, it depends on the workloads that you're utilizing. You know, you're not scaling up to 6,000 users per front end with 12 front end pools in order to handle that throughput, most people, unless you're a hoster and you have the hosting pack in there. So there's a lot of room for wiggle. I know we like specific, static information, but unfortunately, when we look at when Microsoft looks at testing some of these infrastructures, you just can't test every scenario that's available out there. So there's considerable amount of wiggle room. Try it out. Again, with virtualization, The sizing is awesome. You know, when we went from a physical world, I had to buy a box. I had to know my numbers spot on, because if the client came back to me and said, hey, this workload is garbage, I'm having considerable amount of problems, that was a cost, and typically, as the contractor, we ate that cost because we had some bad recommendations. With virtualization now, the sizing and scaling capabilities are really fantastic and really allow you to entertain more quantifiable values that make sense in order to provide the best value to your end users. Edge servers for standard and enterprise deployments, fully supported. Typically, I virtualize all my edge servers. Make sure you're pairing your cards properly. Security people tend to get, I don't want to use that word, upset when you have a host that both has access to the LAN and the internet. You know, so there has to be an education process that happens with your security people, in my experience as well. One of the other key aspects that we can virtualize are reverse proxies. Now, everybody knows TMGs at end of life. What are you doing? Get IIS with AAR up there. It virtualizes amazingly well, and it has great scaling capabilities. And if your client doesn't have hardware load balancers, NLB still works. So, and works in a virtualized environment. So there's some great characteristics that give you value add to looking at virtualizing link workloads. So the first aspect is here, don't mix. If you're going virtual for your front ends, you can't have virtual and physical, okay? The way real-time communications work, the workloads work differently. Even 1 or 2% causes a significant error and is noticeable by your end users. So if you're going virtual, stay virtual. If you're going to go physical and you've got the money to do it, stay physical. But you cannot intermix those machines in a pool. You can't have 6 virtual machines and 2 physical machines in that front-end pool. You will have performance issues. Even though it's very close, 1 to 2% latency on your virtual infrastructure is noticeable versus somebody who's on physical. Or if a physical server fails in an HA design and you flip to virtual, there's noticeable hiccups. Pick one, stick with it. That's the message there. SQL. Fully virtualizable, and probably virtualizes better and takes advantage of a lot of the new technologies that are available in 2012 and 2012 R2, then Exchange and Link. Presence updates are no longer derived from SQL. I don't know how that got in there. We now use the Fabric Manager in order to store stateful state. That's how we're able to do lazy writes to SQL infrastructure now. That's why in 2010, if you lost your SQL backend, it was a horrible experience. You lose your SQL backend in 2013, the end users are not noticing that. As long as your pools are up and the quorum has been achieved across the Fabric Manager, which was a technology that was in Azure that got taken down and put on-prem because it had a lot of beneficial capabilities for throughput. Migration strategies such as live migration are not supported. Again, as mentioned, real-time communications don't handle it. If I'm talking to this box as my MCU and I have a 250-person meeting on that and I do the live state migration and that reset of the ARP occurs, everybody just got dumped from that conference, right? The network needs to reconverge and the new traffic pattern to the new host needs to be found. Although it's typically with inside a ping, your users are going to see that reset. They're all going to get dumped.
So that's just one distinction between Exchange and Link, right? Although they recommend doing application HA capabilities first, that is a supported scenario with Exchange. It's clearly called out as not being supported in Link. Just wanted to level set that one.
Dedicate your network to Link. Don't share NICs. When you're looking at high workloads and real-time communications such as Link, you know, if you've got 4 NICs on your box, we love to really slam everything and, you know, have one NIC, it's LAN, and put 8 machines on that. Well, you're doing that division. So the rule of thumb is when you have these types of high workloads, dedicate the NIC to that machine. Don't share it out. If you've got three front ends, give them each a dedicated NIC. Don't share them out. You want that dedicated throughput, unless, of course, we're talking about 10 gig NICs and higher, where we have considerable throughput capabilities on that infrastructure. But if we're a gig and lower, dedicate it. Don't overutilize it or overcommit it.
Or leverage teaming.
Yeah, or a teaming aspect. Instead of doing failover teaming, look at aggregation across them for throughput capabilities. We support Hyper-V 2 and 3 and VMware as a fully supported infrastructure for virtualization. 2 is supported. Realize that you do cut your workloads at least by 50%, depending on the host, because we required 8 cores in 2010, for instance, depending on your scaling requirements. You're down to 4, so your workloads are going to be cut down, although it is still a supported virtual hypervisor. If you have the capability and you're not a government, like 80% of our clients, throw in the 2012 infrastructure. You're going to get a lot of benefit from the throughput to the CPU, and the NUMA and the dynamic VM queuing capabilities are really going to give you a better density with inside that host than you would see with some of the other technologies. Don't do RAID 5 and 6 anymore. That's not a great idea, right? Start looking, because we are supporting very inexpensive disks, look at striping. If you need some sort of tolerance, do RAID 10. But because the IOP requirements have been reduced significantly, don't RAID 5 and 6. I know that became a very comfortable thing to do a decade ago, but it's been depreciated. It's best, probably not best for these types of workloads. Solid state can be your friend. Depending on your disk capabilities, and solid state drives have considerably come down in cost, and now with the new tiered storage capabilities in 2012 R2, there's some benefits there, especially from an exchange perspective, when we start looking at some of the new filtering capabilities that are on the, I love to think of it as the authentication role and the everything else role, because the authentication box is just a proxy now. You know, there's no real spam, that type of stuff like we did in the previous versions. There's some lightweight filtering capabilities, but we're doing a lot of the heavy workload on the back end role now. So there are some benefits that you can look at there that are great to benefit. More than 24 cores on your box. With the density of cores, if you're looking at doing high-density virtualization, load it up instead of buying another server 6 or 8 months later or a year later. Look at getting that density in the box so that you can actually look at virtualizing these workloads in there. If you've only got 16 cores, you're going to use that up fairly quickly, and it causes you some problems when you look at HA and DR scenarios with inside the virtualization technology. Make sure that you don't overcommit either. You know, if I have a box that's got 16 and a box that's got 24, I'm going to have a problem if one fails over. Make sure that they're the same. And remember host RAM. Number one thing we see is the overcommitment, and the people forget that there's things running on the host. If I've got monitoring, if I've got antivirus, if I have other line of business applications that are touching that host, make sure you haven't overcommitted and you've given something for it. We've seen instances where people have completely committed all the RAM capable, and the host is now bottlenecking the processing capabilities of the hypervisor. Even though we talk directly to the hardware, when the machine needs to do something, it's going to cause you some grief. So make sure that you haven't overcommitted. At least give 4 gigs to the host.
Okay.
Elements to be concerned about for managing. Just a quick overview of some of these things as we start diving into the operations manager aspect. But these are the key pieces that we look at for managing, understanding the workload, the metrics, the monitoring. Enabling users, pretty straightforward, but we're going to go into a lot about synthetic transactions later with the new remote watcher node capabilities, SCOM, very cool stuff. Client updates, depending on, if I have phones, how am I deploying the updates? Are they hitting it from the web service? That type of thing. Enabling enterprise voice. 80% of Link deployments currently have problems because network admins have not right provisioned their network. QoS, DCSP frame tagging, making sure that it's extended and available is key. Microsoft actually changed their support model for Link because customers were calling up saying, my voice is garbage, I have a lot of jitter, things are cacking out. Geez, I'm looking, there's no QoS policy enabled there. Why are you calling me? That's not my cup of tea. Get out there, talk to your network admins. Performance metrics, which we're going to take a look at. We originally surfaced performance metrics and performance counters and boiled them up through Operations Manager. I'm glad there's a management pack that does it for you now. It took us considerable amount of time to get the values we needed, and even the performance of getting that information has changed considerably.
Something like 108 rules? Yeah.
Doesn't make sense, depending on what's important to you, but again, being in the federal space, they want everything. It doesn't matter if they're going to look at that piece of paper or not. It's got to be captured, archived, and stored for 7 years. Some elements of link management to be concerned about. What are we boiling up? What are we surfacing in the management pack now? So call quality, obviously very important. What's that experience like if you have enterprise voice deployed? Or if you're not using enterprise voice and we're looking at PC to PC type capabilities, it's still key. If the user can't call or it's a drop call or that type of thing, it's not a great experience. Component health also being boiled up now into the management pack that's been surfaced. So not only the state or the view state, but we're also looking at how's the web service, how's the file share, what are the different aggregations, which Brad is going to show you in just a few moments in the demonstration of what the new 2013 management pack looks like. Underlying dependencies and components are also surfaced here. So the web scheduler runs on IIS. IIS is down. There's this roll-up and aggregation that surfaced. So underlying components, even if you're monitoring your network, your switches, your firewalls are key and are all surfaced here in the operations pack. Link MP for 2013 is excellent. The remote watcher node for SCOM, very cool. We're all familiar with the test commandlets in Link. If you're a Link administrator, they're great. They actually allow you to try an end-to-end scenario rather than just looking at service state. We leverage these in our new synthetic remote watcher node, which is very slick. We're going to actually go through that and show you some of the information and how it's bubbled up.
Okay. Operations Manager is the tool that we use to monitor Link. We're going to actually integrate with most elements of the System Center stack into sort of a cloud scenario, but I'm going to skip through this quickly so we can get into the demos as soon as possible. Now, with the Link 2013 management packs, this is new, wasn't possible before with 2010, you've got scenario availability from any location, considered with the distributed synthetic transactions, which are launched through PowerShell. We're actually going to demonstrate something like that in front of you, where we're going to demonstrate a failover over there. You've also got exposed those synthetic transaction logs, so you can view what's been happening as the synthetic transaction runs through. You've got some increased call reliability coverage. The IM and conferencing nodes are now exposed within the management pack. You were able to get to that stuff before, but you had to actually write rules and go through and get it discovered and so forth. You've also got some dependency monitoring in there as well. So just some quick notes to the hardware requirements. The 2013 management pack will work on 2007 R2 or 2012. You've got that watcher node, which does the synthetic transactions to give you some real value to your monitoring infrastructure.
Basic recommendation.
You want to have 8 gigs of memory, and then you've got the basic quad core recommendations and so forth. Just some quick note to the different views. These are within the management pack, so I'll actually show that to you. You've got the individual monitoring views. These are already scoped by the product team. So inside any alert, you've got severity and priority, which are the two sort of key pieces of information to quickly tell you health state of your environment. Well, the product team has gone through and already sort of predefined these alerts and health states based on critical classes that you're concerned with in your environment, servers, pools, sites, and then they've gone and set up the deployment diagram. And then for the alerts themselves, instead of just giving you an all alert view, what they've done is they've set up using business rules, and they filtered on priority. Okay? From there, you'll see different severities and health states and so forth.
Now, what I was trying to show here with the remote watcher node now in 2013 is you can put this node anywhere in order to test end-to-end scenarios for your users. The remote watcher node system does not need to be domain joined. If you want to start looking at federation, remote access, mobile testing, what a great place to put a small instance node in a cloud provider, for instance, and have that feeding the information back. Because when you're looking with inside the infrastructure, you may not be knowing that the hardware load balancer failed if you're not monitoring, or there's a firewall issue, or your admin made a change on some of the security policies. So the ability to put the node anywhere in a topology, regardless whether you own it or not, starts surfacing some excellent information from a monitoring perspective. Because ideally what we're trying to do is know before the user tells you, right? Proactive versus reactive capabilities. So this is a great way in order to test that end-to-end scenario and really see what's going on. So without ado, let's jump into a demo and start showing some of the product.
Okay. So we're going to demonstrate integration with Operations Manager. I know Derek did the rounds, and a lot of you are interested in that. So we've actually got loaded here the Link 2013 Management Pack, and it'll just take me a second to
just close it and reconnect this.
Refresh that view.
It was the same thing. Our VPN client doesn't like some of the dynamicness of the network, so we shouldn't try to pre-open our machines and be ready for you, is what the rule of thumb is telling us here.
It's trying to say don't be prepared in a live demo. So as we were saying before, the management pack already sets up the different scoping of the views, right? So if you get, say for example, if you're an operations manager administrator, you've got that sort of active alerts view right at the top. Well, there's a lot of information in there. Usually scoping down to the individual management packs gives you very specific information, and the product team has gone and actually scoped that further to give you more relevant info on those business rules that you can configure based on priority, being high, low, medium, right? So inside there, of course, one of the first things you might pick out is, so we've got high priority alerts. We can see that there's a severity critical alert in there right now, which has to do with an element of our Link server inside the lab. Beyond that, you've got the different classes which are configured here. You've got your sites, you've got your pools, and then you've got your servers, right? You can surface some performance information as well, which is pretty cool inside the system. I'll dig that up for you in just a second. So if we look under the enterprise front ends, right, we can grab the sort of the VM1 host right over here, and we can surface any performance information that he's got, which will help me very quickly figure out how the server's performing, which is scoped to that particular role. So over time, I've got some rules running in the environment. I can gather different performance information. If I need quick troubleshooting snapshot-based information, I can rejig the time range to make it more relevant. By default, it's going to be set to 7 days. That's an operations manager default. You can lower that to, say, within the last hour or 2 hours. Or you can change the rule and the frequency with which it collects the data. So say if it collects the data every 5 minutes or every hour, you can bring that down if you need to troubleshoot for a scenario and just enable the rule for X amount of time where you need to do a troubleshooting session, and then you've got your performance view to validate that information as well. You can also report on this information, because as information from SCOM gets written into the operations database, it also gets written into the data warehouse, so you can pull that information out and get at it with reports at a later date as well. Okay. So the monitoring and surfaced information in Operations Manager is pretty key to tell you what's going wrong very quickly. You've also got a health state view. So say, for example, if I'm looking at something like a server, right, within Link, I'll pick up here, I'll grab one of the servers, and what I'll do is I'll right-click on that and say open a health state view. And it'll immediately go through and scope to any components which are in critical state, right? So you can very quickly find any information. Bearing in mind, this is a lab we're running at Systel, right? We've all worked with lab environments.
How many would have a heart attack if they saw that in production? I blew away the front-end server in order to show you some
things with
Scorch.
So if you want the big picture, you don't have to go just by what it's scoped to. You can get rid of the sort of scoping up here. And then what it'll do is it'll wind back, and it'll target to the class and show you absolutely every bit of information with the health state according to that, whether that be warning health state informational or so on or so forth. Now, beyond that, you can also use Operations Manager as a communication mechanism, right? So you've got the monitoring capability where you can pull information from the system, but how can I use Operations Manager to go through Link? Well, the number one notification subscription mechanism is email. So we use Exchange or we use another email system. What we can do is we can also configure Link as a secondary notification channel, so you can configure that as sort of your fault-tolerant way to communicate out as well. Okay, so you've also got your reporting. So just a quick piece of information here. You can very quickly run a report on how many alerts you've got in your system. Here we're running, what I'll do is I'll change the time period to say this week from Sunday, and I'll select all the Link components and I'll show the top 10 alerts, and then I'll run that report. And you get some pretty cool information here to do with your Link systems, right? You can see what types of alerts you've got, what priority they are, any changes to do with that, and then you can get some pretty cool detailed role-based and sort of task-based information in that report as well, which you can set up new reports and drill into and get some more current information as well. So that's just the basics of how we use Operations Manager to manage Link. Now, to configure the notification subscription, you, of course, use the same mechanism that you do any other way. You set up the channel, you set up your subscribers using administration. I don't want to dive deep. That's pure Operations Manager. But then Link is a capable subsystem that you can set up to as a secondary communication device. Using connectors in Operations Manager, you can actually take the information from Operations Manager and pull that into other systems, such as Service Manager, right?
Oh, Brad, that's a great segue into the next demo.
What? Are we demoing on Service Manager?
You sure are.
Jeez, imagine that. Okay, so just to sort of show you what we're doing here, I'll flip into Service Manager and just show you some of that information.
Can't be ready for a live environment, Brad.
This goes to show you what being prepared will do.
One of the other things as a nice little fill-in segue right now, the management packs for CDR call reporting as well pull from the monitoring infrastructure of Link. So very relevant information as you're boiling in and leveraging that, so it's very key. You forgot to click force. We need to wait a couple minutes.
A different user.
Yeah, use any of them. There you go.
Okay, there we go. All right. So, all right, we've got, what we're doing is actually, I'll just quickly tell you what we're going to show in the next demo as well. Derek has got Link actually failing over and being monitored from a run book, and then that information is being surfaced. You'll get the alert in Operations Manager, and because we've configured a subscription to communicate from Operations Manager to Service Manager, you'll get that incident request that gets created as well. So Link is being monitored by Operations Manager, generates an alert, the alert comes in, we've got a subscription tying into Service Manager, generate a service request. An incident request. And then from here, we've actually configured activities and a workflow which will go and fire off a correction.
How many people have a help desk here or a ticketing system? How many people's systems can actively receive alerts from monitoring infrastructure and automatically create the incident for you? Awesome. How many of those machines can actually then do a workflow and rectify the issue for you and go back and close the alert and tie all that beautiful ITIL MOF information into it? Okay, so that's kind of where we're going with this. We're going to show you that end-to-end System Center capabilities. The only guys that are raising their hand, obviously, are running System Center.
So what we've done is we've gone through and we've defined some activities which are going to tie into the orchestrator runbooks. We've exposed those runbooks again with the functionality of another connector to go from Service Manager to Orchestrator. And then what we've done is we've gone and exposed some fields which are available through the bus in Orchestrator, which can now pull the information from the incident request that it gets in turn from the monitored object, right? So here we're getting some field data that we're pulling from the orchestration runbook. And then what we're going to do is we're going to pass that information both in the incident request as log data, but we're also going to use that information in Orchestrator inside the runbook to perform some activities, right?
So this is really the man in the middle. I don't want to go through too much of Service Manager because of time, but really what it is we're capturing a ticket, a incident, so that all of our auditing and our compliance people are very happy. They have an issue because as IT individuals, I don't know if you're like me, but if I see a hot potato, I jump on it and I fix it. I tend not to document everything I should. I tend not to notify everybody I should because, hey, the service is out. I've got users complaining to me. My cell phone's ringing. I want to fix the problem. So rather than relying on my improper internal workflows, the system will do it for you. That's kind of the short answer. We gather the alert, we create the incident, the incident comes in, depending on specific characteristics of the incident, in this case we have a failed incident, we then pull an activity. There's a couple of demonstrations I'm going to do with Orchestrator and show you a couple of ways to carve this. One would be to have Service Manager invoke the activity for us.
That's sort of the manual way to do it.
Or have Scorch monitor Service Manager and watch for the incident specifically. And that's kind of the more preferred way, but I'm going to show you both flavors because it's not really that much difference to rejig.
Okay, so we'll let Derek flip over to the Orchestrator presentation. While he's doing that, just so you know, like Operations Manager can run tasks, Service Manager has the capability to do that as well. So within an incident request, right, you can actually go in, and if you've got runbook activities exposed, you could launch that yourself, which can actually draw into the runbook and launch that manually, or another way you could do it is sort of a la Operations Manager, which is configure a task which would tie in and perform those functions for you. And you can expose those and run those directly from within the service request. Derek's actually configured a runbook to monitor a service request that comes in. So we've got two things happening. I sort of explained the process.
I can show it now. I've got it up.
Okay. Let's, instead of listening to me talk, we'll watch Derek show.
So the first one here is if we were invoking the runbook by calling it from Service Manager, okay? So in the runbook activity sequence that we're using, we pass the data by utilizing the initialized data field. And very, very simply, I'm only pulling one object here because I just want to know. Oh, I've got to stop it. I'm sorry. I want to know the activity ID, right? I need to know what's been passed to me from Service Manager so that I can then utilize that later, ideally, close the incident once I've rectified the issue. So we grab that information. We know that there's an issue, and what that information is, we query the object as well and pass this on. Now, what I've done here for people that are not PowerShell-friendly people is shown that if you don't want to write PowerShell and you don't want to script it, we can actually use a CMD-type interface here where we're calling the PowerShell on the other box to do something. If people aren't familiar with an implicit remoting or CRED SP capabilities, this is probably the easiest way for you to get Scorch up and running in order to do some automation tasks. Quite simply, it's a command execution that we're running, not a program. What's the computer I'm executing from? Where's the PowerShell executable? And then I append a command with a PS1 that's being leveraged on that remote server. So quite simply, a little PS1, maybe we have our invoke CS management server or invoke CS pool failover or failback. Put that in the PS1 and execute it, knowing that this one's paired to this one. It's very static information in a small environment, and we can automate that process. We put the working folder where the PS1 script is being run from and simply execute it. For those who aren't familiar with Orchestrator, this is the service bus. This is how we pass information from one object to another. And we can also declare some variables to the bus to create if-then-else type logic. So specifically, if the command fails, I want an email about it. Pretty simple. If the command is successful, then let's move on to the next step. Now, in an enterprise deployment, before you can fail over the pool, you've got to fail over the CMS infrastructure. So if we don't complete a successful failover of CMS, we've got other problems that we need to take a look at. Once the completion of CMS is done, then we're doing the same type of activity. What's the box, where we're executing it from, and what's the working directory? There is also the ability to pass run as credentials as well, depending on your services and your workflow account and what it's capable of doing. Again, some simplistic logic behind it. To close it, we want to then update the service request. We're pulling the initialized data activity ID that was passed to us from the call from service manager to orchestrator, set it to resolved, and then email me. It's all done. So ideally, what this is doing is you're not getting that 2 a.m. call or that 2 a.m. page. As soon as it failed, the incident was created. Automatically, we called the orchestrator runbook to fail over from pool 1 to pool 2. Everybody's happy. You can come at clock 7 a.m. for us, but if you're in Spain, you come in around 9:30. Take a look at the server, test the infrastructure, fix the problem, and fail it back. Now, a better way of doing this. For those that are PowerShell hungry and want to look at some more interesting ways of leveraging it, rather than having Service Manager initiate the task, because there's delays in this as well, right? Even the remote watcher node only does transactions out of the box every 15 minutes. So maybe I don't want to wait for one system to call the other. In this instance, what I'm doing is monitoring Service Manager. And very simple, I'm looking for a title that says the link front end NT service failed. Okay, and this is quantifiable. Rather than waiting for time in Orchestrator, I can say check every 30 seconds, check every minute, check every 2 minutes. So there's less of a lag as one system calls to the other. Obviously, I'm looking for a new triggered event, not an updated. I only want to deal with these types of issues as they're created. And I have to say, I'm not a full expert on PowerShell outside of Link. Thank God we have a PowerShell MVP on staff, because some of this CRED SSP and implicit remoting, unless Exchange is doing it for you, can be somewhat of a challenge. This is not the best way. This is a preferred way. The best way would be I wouldn't be passing clear text credentials in a script. I would be doing a secure string variable in Orchestrator and leveraging it there, rather than transmitting the credentials this way, and anything clear text freaks security people out in the end. So what I'm doing is I'm building my credentials here rather than using the fabulous get credential, because if it pops up and asks me for my credentials, is the script going to run at 2 o'clock in the morning? Probably not. I build my login and I set it to a variable, my username domain. I'm setting my password to clear password. I'm setting my credentials. Then I'm setting up my new remoting session, specifically passing my credentials over to it rather than being prompted for them. I enter the remote session that I've just created, and then I invoke what it is that I'm looking at doing. So for this instance, I'm looking at failing over the CMS first. Fail over, what's the fully qualified domain name of the backup SQL server and my enterprise deployment? Throw the nice little force on there. A little caveat too, depending on your variables in PowerShell, we've all been prompted. Microsoft is notorious for this. Are you sure you want to do it? Are you really sure you want to do it? Okay, let's do it, right? The Unix admins that I talk to just drives them nuts. If I'm doing something from the CLI and hit enter, I know what I'm doing, damn it, just do it. So declare your variables. Set those session variables up on the boxes where you don't want to be prompted for warnings or alerts so that it doesn't ask you, are you sure you want to do it? Obviously, if I've scripted it, I've tested this out, I'm not flying blindly by the seat of my pants in production, hopefully, and everything's good and gold. Now in turn, some logic behind it, pass and fail. Then simply, I build my credentials again. A better way would have been to store this in a global variable in Orchestrator and using a secure variable state, but I wanted to show you some shelling capabilities for those that aren't quite tech savvy in that side of things. Same type of thing, build my login, create my session, open my session, and then in this instance, let's fail the pool over now, because we know that the CMS was successful or it wouldn't have gone on to the next state because of the if-then-else logic that I put on the service bus. Finally, we want to update the incident, close it. I get the incident ID because I've monitored it at the start. We can set it to resolved or closed depending on the logic that you use. And then finally, send the email that says, hey, everything's done, we're great, don't wake up, stay asleep. If you wanted, you could put a little failure thing and have an SMS page, geez, you know, I puked on the second command, you really do need to come in. You know, that's how life works sometimes. So from an overall state, there's some differences whether you're using PowerShell and you're comfortable with it and you want to do implicit remoting, or if you are not quite as savvy, you can actually run a PS1 or a command or a program on the other box that actions it for you.
Okay, so we're good to go. All right, so just to sort of wrap things up here. So we spoke to you about virtualization and some of the new capabilities in Server 2012 R2. We covered how and why you'd virtualize Exchange 2013 and Link 2013 and some of those considerations. We demonstrated managing the Link subsystem with Operations Manager, Service Manager, and also that you can create runbooks to sort of autocorrect actions within the Link subsystem as well. Okay.
We just picked Link because I'm a Link MVP. You know, if I had been an Exchange MVP or SharePoint MVP, we would have picked that. But the idea is that Orchestrator, Opalis, now purchased, you know, back April 2009-ish, really allows you to integrate and leverage, and it is our automation workflow engine regardless of the product state. Even though Service Manager does have some basic automation capabilities, you want to take it to the next level. There's great integration packs with operations with Scorch that are out there, but we found that even the community is developing some awesome IPs. There's a gentleman, Ryan from General Mills. You should see some of the IPs that he's created. So if you're looking at some of the extensible stuff that's not under the Microsoft realm, take a look at scorch.coplex.com. There's some great IPs there that you can leverage.
So just in case some of you aren't familiar with that, by IP, Derek is referring to the integration packs. So the way we bring management packs into Operations Manager and Service Manager, that's tantamount to integration packs with Orchestrator. And so a lot of what we did could have been potentially accomplished had there been an integration pack for Link. There's not. So what we did was we demonstrated that you can actually compensate for those capabilities using PowerShell, right? You can drag in a .NET object or drag in a command object and leverage a PowerShell script to sort of bridge that gap in capability to get what you want done. So there's virtually any solution that is possible using Orchestrator and System Center today.
So we'll turn it over to you guys. Any questions? We've got 3 minutes and 48 seconds. Wow, that's awesome. No questions. Very unusual. Usually in North America, I'd have some swag up here, and that would drive the questions, but you know, it doesn't seem to be quite the same here.
Okay. Well, then that's it, guys. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Hopefully you get some good sessions. Please don't forget to evaluate our sessions. If you like to see content like this, please provide feedback, which we consider very serious, and we use it in order to create future sessions for you. Thank you very much.